This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
It's good to see you all here at this unusual church camp. I wouldn't say it's entirely different from a church camp, as you've just been told. I was at the dorms last night, after all, and there are some things that are common to all camps when young people get together, but I'm sure the content will be much different and the intensity will be much higher. But you're the right people to be here for this. And I thought to myself, it's really too bad that I have to have my week taken up teaching this course when the Olympics is starting. Because I've been looking forward to seeing the dream team at work. But you know, the Lord's been working in my heart, helping me to be able to accept the fact that I can't watch that 24 hours a day on three channels, going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Because, you know, when you think about it, and I don't say this as false flattery, in a real sense, you're the dream team, not the basketball team that's there, which I think very deservedly is being praised and probably will trounce all of its opponents and so forth. But the title that Gary gave me to speak on, Defending the Christian Worldview Against All Comers, really makes you the dream team if you catch on to what I want to teach you, and if the Lord will bless me to teach you well this week. Because in the same way that Magic Johnson and Larry Bird and Michael Jordan and these others are able to take on all comers and beat them by 60, 70 points, if you learn what it is to defend the Christian faith in a biblically sound and faithful way, believe it or not, as inadequate as you feel right now, if you had to stand up against some PhD who was lecturing and has been around for a number of years, you will be able to take on all comers. I promise you that. There is no doubt about it. In fact, once you catch on to the method of defending the faith that I'm going to try to teach you, you're going to find that in one sense it's remarkably easy to do. Now last night, many of you saw a man who had mastered magic tricks. I'm told that what makes a magic trick especially effective is if it is simple, right? But it looks complicated. And then you work and work and work trying to figure things out. I'm glad that Danny taught us some of the things that he does last night. It's really very valuable to me, because now when I go around speaking places, I can do some of these things. I was confident. I looked at this, I said, I can do that. I understand. I especially like the bent spoon trick, you know, the way he did that. You know, so quickly hitting the spoon like that, no one caught on doing that. So I started practicing last night. I figured, I'll do even better. I'm going to use a fork. Nah, I'm not going to do that anymore. Anyway, as with a magic trick, so with philosophical analysis, it's really much simpler than it seems at first. I will not say that it's simplistic. I think Gary is right to tell you you're going to have to work hard, and it's not just this week. Hopefully, we'll whet your appetite, but you're going to have to work hard all through your college experience, and I trust you'll keep reading, keep thinking, keep applying all through your life. You're going to keep working hard. It isn't going to come easy in the way that you can lay back in a hammock and fall asleep. It isn't going to be easy that way. But it is not going to be the intimidating task that it sometimes seems to you to deal with those who are scholars, who are unbelievers, and who are downright hostile to Christianity. Yesterday at the Orange County Airport, I had an interesting experience. I was getting ready to check in, get on a plane for Chicago, and from Chicago here to Atlanta. A little old lady was in front of me in line. She comes up to the counter and really sweet. I felt really bad for her, but she said, the number says on my ticket that I'm supposed to get on this plane, but I'm going to Hartford. So the agent looked at the ticket and said, yes, ma'am, you're going to Chicago and you're going to change planes and go to Hartford. And she said, well, I'm supposed to go to Hartford, not to Chicago. The agent said, yes, that's right. You're going to go first to Chicago, then you're going to change planes, and then you're going to go to Hartford. And she thought for a minute, and you can almost see it kind of sink in, and she said, oh, okay. And she went over and sat down, and then I stepped up to the counter. And just about that time, she jumped up from her seat. She said, but it says on the board, Chicago, Boston. The agent said, yes, you're going to go to Chicago, get off the plane, get on a plane for Hartford. But it says Boston. You know, and you know what the problem is. You know that it's simple. It's easy to take care of. But she's intimidated. She's scared. She's going to go to the wrong place. I don't know why her family wasn't there to help her. I felt very bad for her, but she was by herself and very confused by this. And she was afraid if she got on this plane, even though you can change planes in Chicago, she was going to end up in Boston. And that isn't where she wanted to go. Unbelievers are something of the opposite, though, of what that little old lady was going through yesterday. They have chosen a way of looking at the world and a way of thinking and a way of living that is going to land them in Boston. Pardon the expression. Maybe we should say Boston Harbor so you know how bad it is. Is going to land them in Boston, and they think they can get off the plane in Chicago, but they can't. And basically what I want to teach you to do is not let them off the plane. When they've chosen a worldview, make sure they know they're going all the way to Boston. And in this case, it means all the way to hell. And hell doesn't simply mean, but it certainly is the most important meaning. It doesn't simply mean that after they go through this life, they're going to face the judgment of God and be utter terror for the rest of eternity. That is hell. But hell has begun on earth for those who will not know the source of life, Jesus Christ. And hell has begun on earth not just because their family lives are messed up, not just because their own psychological state is messed up, not just because there's social problems among unbelievers, but hell has begun intellectually as well. Unbelievers don't ordinarily, although sometimes they do, and that's why we latch onto these examples when we see them, but they don't ordinarily let on that intellectually things are really messed up for them. But things are. And they are on their way to Boston, but they think they can get off at Chicago. They think there's a way off. And there isn't. Except for the counter worldview that is found in the Bible. Now, did you understand what I just said? Do you follow that? Unbelievers have chosen a way of looking at the world and looking at how they know what they know and looking at how they should live their lives, which is contrary to what the Bible teaches. And because they've chosen that, they've got it off. They're on a plane that's heading somewhere they don't want to end up. And they're looking for a place to bail, but there isn't one. And so you're going to defend the faith by running their faith right into the ground, or into Boston, if I use the metaphor properly. So if you understand that, I guess we can call it a day, right? We'll come back tomorrow and just kind of put something on this. Well, we got a few extra minutes, so maybe we'll use that time wisely. This week, I want to talk to you about the antagonism of unbelieving worldviews. Try to convince you that when you are dealing with unbelieving professors, unbelieving roommates, students at the college, that you're dealing with a worldview, you're dealing with an underlying philosophy, not simply with the eyeball observational facts. The facts are not what's really at stake, although it will sometimes seem like that. It seemed like, well, if we could just marshal better historical evidence or better scientific evidence or better psychological evidence or whatever the field may be, if we could just get the facts, then we would win the respect of these people or these professors. But that isn't where the issue really is. You do need to know the facts. In fact, you need to know the facts better than your professors. That will seem intimidating, but it is possible. Believe it or not, your professors, you remember the story of Gideon in the Bible? You know how Gideon set the Philistines into utter, you know, terror of mind, into flight? He gave every one of his soldiers what was really the mark of the leader of a band of soldiers. Gave him the light that would lead them into the battle. And so as the Midianites looked up there and saw that all of these, you know, lights, I said, there must be a huge army behind that. Well, there wasn't. That was the army. They were seeing everything. But because they thought there was so many there, then they took off afraid. And, of course, Gideon fell upon them. In the same way, unbelievers practice the Gideon strategy. They like to give you the idea that they are familiar with what's going on. They know all the options. They've read through them. They're way ahead of the game. Well, I don't want to be unrealistic and just turn it around and pretend like we know all the options and we know better than they. But I want you to be reminded of the fact that they're finite. And not just finite, they are lazy. And not just that, they are prejudicial. So when they get into a certain groove of thinking, they tend to pay attention to reading that follows that line of thought. They do not pay as much attention to others. Sometimes they just bluff. Your professors don't know as much as they think they do. And you know what they don't know for sure? They don't know the philosophical implications of their position, or they wouldn't be teaching this. Nor do they understand the Christian position. I suppose I could have an entire hour just on this one point. I'm going to take 2 minutes, though. Please take me at my word. If nothing else, just because I've been through, you know, the hoops. I've jumped through all the hoops, you know, proven that I can memorize like others. I can do footnotes like others. I can do this. I can do that. Just so I can play their game with them. I've gone through that for years and years and years. I went through that. Anybody who's been to graduate school as a Christian, has come out alive, knows what I'm talking about. You play the game. You learn how to do it. You have to impress them that you can do this, that, and the other. So I've done this for a long time, and I am dead certain that 90% of the people who oppose Christianity explicitly, in my experience, did not know what Christianity was. That's going to seem remarkable. You would think, well, the gospel's so simple, it's at every street corner. There's the big Baptist church down the street. I mean, everybody's got to know what the gospel is. These people know, and they've decided it's not true. Well, they have decided it's not true, but I'm also convinced they do not understand what it is. They do not know your worldview as well as you do. Nor do they understand that their worldview is going to Boston, which is to say, going to hell. Pardon me if you're from Boston. Going to hell. So you will be able to do this. I want you to see the antagonism of the unbeliever and to know that the facts, or what are called the facts, eyeball, observational type things, are not what separates you from the unbeliever. It's underlying worldviews. And so we're going to talk about philosophy. Not today. I have to warm you up to that. But everyone does philosophy. Not everyone does it well, but everyone does it. And so as Gary was telling you in the introduction, if I can teach you something about philosophical principles, whether you go on to be philosophy majors or not, I will have done you a favor. Because you'll be able to apply this whatever field you go into. It could be architecture. Believe me, philosophical principles apply to architecture. And I see those skeptical looks on your faces. Okay, you want me to prove that it applies to architecture? Actually, in the ancient world, architecture was often a reflection of their philosophy. Not just affected by it. Architecture was in one... Take the ancient Egyptians and their pyramids. Take their symbols, you know, the eye, top of the pyramid. Why did they have these sorts of things? Do they think that was artistically pleasing? Anybody seen an eyeball at the top of the pyramid? It's not very pleasing at all, but it's very telling in terms of what they thought the nature of reality was and how we know about it. Yeah, philosophy applies to every field, and so we're going to spend some time talking about philosophy, and then most of the week we're going to deal with false worldviews, false philosophies. I'm going to try to give you some hand grenades that you can take into class with you, you know, from the field experience that I've had. Some of the issues which in any field are going to have to be addressed philosophically and are not addressed well by unbelievers. I'll go through the... what I think are the basic types of worldviews that are available and do an internal critique of each one of them. And then I'll talk about at least, well, if the Lord gives me the time, at least half dozen of the major problems that will be raised by unbelievers when they finally realize they've got to now defend themselves. They're going to come back at you with some things. And I'm going to try to talk about at least a half dozen of those sorts of issues. So that kind of plans out the week for you. Let's begin by realizing that although we're defending the Christian faith, we're going to try to do that rationally, we're going to try to use our intellects. Nevertheless, the Christian faith is just that. It's the Christian faith. You notice we don't speak of, I'm an adherent of Christian rationality. I'm an adherent of Christian philosophy. I mean, I say that every once in a while, but I doubt that very many of us, and I don't very often talk that way. What we adhere to is called the faith. According to an old saw, faith is believing what you know ain't true. And when you get off to college, you're going to find that the students that you talk to and the professors that bother to interact with you will pretty much have that understanding that you've come as a Christian, but you're really living in two worlds. One, the world of reason, the world of intellect, the world of scholarship represented by the university. That's the one temple you worship at. And then on Sundays, you go to another kind of temple, another kind of sanctuary, and there you worship and you express your faith. And these two don't have anything to do with each other, except they're all part of one week for you. They're all part of your experience, but they don't really have any internal connection. Faith is one thing, rationality is another. And the devil would love for you to believe that. And sadly, there are some who profess to follow Jesus Christ, and I hope with all my heart that they do, but nevertheless, they profess to follow Jesus, but they're secret agents for the devil. Because they will encourage you to think that way too. That we have intellect and rationality over here and faith over here. They are two different ball games. And faith is believing what you know ain't true. Now, there's a real advantage. I'm going to admit this. I don't think it's going to be worth the disadvantage. But let me tell you straight out, there is a real advantage if you believe that, if you follow that way of thinking. If that's your mindset, then you don't have to worry about anything you encounter at the university, do you? Since faith is believing what you know ain't true, when they prove that Christianity ain't true, you don't have to worry about that. That just increases my faith. You see, the more you show me that I can't believe this, the more religious I am to hold on. I've actually known people. It's not just, you know, theologians that talk this kind of nonsense. I've known people who live their lives that way. And, you know, like a biology student, you know, who says he's come to believe that the Bible can't be trusted scientifically. It's all messed up. Just an ancient book of superstition. I said, well, then why do you believe the miracles about Jesus and his resurrection? Well, I know it isn't possible. I mean, I understand that. I've been taught that. But that just makes it all the more religious. I hold on to Jesus by faith. Wow. What an insult. What an insult to the Lord of history. What an insult to the Lord Jesus Christ to say, I'm holding on to you, Jesus, knowing that you ain't true. Do you understand that? Faith is not, from our perspective, believing what you know isn't true. Yet I know that in our society, this concept of faith is very popular. That is a tendency among people. When they want to hold to something rather fantastic, they want to believe that UFOs have come and visited us, or if they want to hold on to something which will be considered deplorable or pathetic, they continue to honor some politician that's been discredited and they want to believe in the honor of this man and so forth. When you ask them why they believe these things, they will often say, I just have faith. Is there any evidence for what you believe? No. Or it's rather meager or extremely difficult to believe that it leads to the conclusion that they are holding to. They hold on to these convictions very strongly, very personally, and then fall back on the idea that they can believe things by faith. Even if what they believe doesn't appear to be true, and there seems to be very good reason for not believing it, they think that they can continue with their conviction because they believe it on faith. They persist in believing in the name of faith. Now, because you hear that, I trust you've seen that in the tabloids, television, what the movies portray as religion and so forth, that is the general concept that people have of faith. Faith is believing things for which there's very little reason, or believing things for which there's a lot of reason that you shouldn't believe them. Faith then comes to be seen as irrational or contrary to reason. Faith is seen as a personal commitment against all the obstacles that stand in the way of being honest and reasonable and looking at the evidence. I hold on to this conviction, then I have faith. And so when you go off to college, as someone known to have faith, and as someone who encourages others to have faith, you will be immediately misperceived as someone who is calling for the crucifixion of the intellect. To have faith means to let your emotions run wild and turn off your brain. Christians live in two worlds, then, your professors think. They live in this emotional world. All these little things they do on Sunday morning, especially if you're Pentecostal. Do all these emotional things, but then Monday through Friday, and sometimes on Saturday if you use the library, Monday through Friday, your brain kicks back in. Okay, so it's like brain off, brain on. Go to church, brain off. Go to school, brain on. You get the point? Faith means the brain is off. The emotions are running. High degree of personal volition and commitment. Take this. Dictionary philosophy. There's a man who teaches in my field. He's supposed to know better. Peter Engels defines faith as belief in something despite the evidence against it. Faith in something despite the evidence against it, or belief in something even though there is an absence of evidence for it. So if you take either one of those understandings of what faith is, when we as Christians claim to have faith in the Bible, faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, we're going to be looked upon as irrational people. People who have turned off the brain and are letting our emotions run. We have a high degree of volitional commitment. Faith becomes a buzzword for living in two worlds. And I hate to tell you this because I don't wish to insult you, but you won't. Well, maybe you will. But I don't think you'll hear as much as you probably should about how you will be disdained for having that concept of faith. People will think you are stupid. And you know what? If that is your concept of faith, you are. Now, I trust that you don't want to follow that understanding of faith. That's why you're at this particular conference. You want to be prepared to deal with college life, with life in general. You want to be able to deal with the opposition to Christianity, not by saying, oh, well, we don't worry about whether it's true or false. We just turn off our brain and enjoy feeling good about Jesus. And the Bible doesn't teach that view of faith. And because it doesn't teach it, I think it is fair to say, without trying to be personally insulting, it is stupid to believe that. It'd be better just to say Christianity is not true, but it makes me feel good. Just like the idea that there's a Santa Claus used to make me feel good, you know? It'd be better to say that about Jesus than to say, well, I believe in Jesus because I have faith, even though I know it's not true. Christianity is going to be looked upon as irrational by the people you come in contact with in school. But when they say that Christianity is irrational, they will not all mean the same thing by that. And so we're going to spend a few minutes, I'll try to make use of the board here, to draw some distinctions so that you might understand very clearly what the different kinds of irrationality are with which you might be charged. Let's count how many ways there are to be irrational, okay? That is, how many different ways will your having faith in Jesus Christ or faith in the Bible be deemed stupid by people at the university? Some people will pit Christian faith against reason because they feel that the teachings of the Bible are themselves, the specific teachings of the Bible, are irrational. Some people, for instance, will look upon the idea of God becoming man as a logical contradiction. They'll look at the incarnation as irrational. For them, this idea of there being a God-man is incoherent. It's a violation of the alleged laws of logic. And so when they charge Christianity with being irrational, what they mean is that it is contrary to the rules of logic. It is illogical. So here's one way to be irrational. Am I writing large enough that you can read that? Okay, violate the laws of logic. When somebody says Christianity is irrational, they might mean very specifically you believe things like the Trinity or the Incarnation. You believe things which are illogical. There's another way that is a pointed way in which we are considered irrational. People will sometimes think there is utterly no observational, scientific, historical substantiation for the magnificent claims that are made in the Bible. The Bible tells us the sun stood still. It tells us that Jesus multiplied the loaves, that he raised the dead. Now, when you look at claims like that and say that's irrational, and what you mean is there's no evidence for that, there's no scientific explanation for that, what you're getting at is that there are empirical defects in the claims made by Christians or in the claims found in the Bible. And I want no one to be embarrassed. We're going to do this all week long. I have to find out. How many of you know what that word empirical means? Better, how many of you don't? Okay, let's talk about that for a second. You know what logic is? We have some general idea. We're going to come back later in the week and talk about it too. In the ancient world, among the Greek philosophers, there were two basic approaches to doing philosophy. I like to simplify it for my beginning students by saying some philosophers said, if you want to figure out the world, you have to stop and think about it. Kind of like go to your armchair, sit down, and reflect. Now, if this is the case, then how can that be the case, and how do I bring these two things together? Now, philosophers who followed that stop-and-think technique were rationalists. They said we need clear and distinct ideas. We need to make our ideas consistent with each other. What's really important is the life of the mind, making sure that the things that I hold to don't conflict with one another. Other philosophers were less patient with that. Theirs was the go-look-and-see method of figuring out the world. That is, they said, whatever you may imagine in your armchair as you're speculating and using your reason, we've got to make, you know, sense out of what we encounter in the world, what we see and what we touch, what we taste. We need to have the facts. That's what Americans think are the facts. The facts are what you can touch, what you can see. And so they were the seeing is believing sort of philosopher. Now, the seeing is believing philosophy is known as empiricism. Empiricism. Technically, empiricism says all that you know can be reduced to observational posits. But we aren't going to get into the full-blown theory of it. I just want you to know how the adjective empirical is used. If I say empirical, I'll be referring to a way of knowing that's dependent upon observation, personal experience, or the senses. Okay, now back to the point. Some people would criticize Christianity as being irrational because they say it is contrary to the empirical evidence. So here are two ways to be irrational, two ways to be criticized for being irrational. If there is no substantiation for the claims made in the Bible, no empirical substantiation, or if the claims made in the Bible are in conflict with each other, logically speaking, then we will be told that we are irrational. That is to say, such critics will find specific imperfections in Christianity, and they'll go after them. They'll say, how can you believe that an axe head can float? How can you believe in creation, the special creation of man? How can you believe that a man is actually God? So they're going after specific imperfections. And this may, you may think, wow, these are pretty strong, you know, criticisms. But I'm going to bracket them for right now. We'll deal with them throughout the week. Take my word for it. Those are the easy ones. Really, if it comes down to that, if we just have to show that our various dogmas are logically consistent, if we just have to show that we are not in conflict with the known principles of science or historiography or something like that, it's a cakewalk. It may not look like that to you because you haven't had as much experience in the field. And it does take research and it does take thinking to deal with those, but they are relatively simple. I want to deal with the tougher forms of irrationality or the charges against us of being irrational. Much more vicious is the claim made by critics who judge that the Christian faith is irrational because they say to be religious or to be a Christian is to be dedicated to believing the absurd for its absurdity. I want to make a point here, a distinction that's very important. I might believe that Jesus, well, I do believe that Jesus rose from the dead, and somebody might say, that's absurd. But what he means by that is, it's empirically defective to believe that sort of thing. It's unscientific. I'm not talking about that kind of criticism. I'm now talking about the criticism that says, you believe something that's absurd just because it is absurd. That's the conception of faith that many people have. Many think that religious believers glory in the fact that their faith is without rational support. They glory in the fact that it's apparently untrue, that it has to be endorsed in the face of good sense and over against contrary reasons. And sadly, unbelievers who think that that is what faith is all about have often been given the damnable help of certain Christian theologians who will say that Christianity is indifferent to logic. We don't care about logic, really. We're indifferent to science. We're indifferent to evidence. In fact, it gets so bad among the neo-Orthodox that sometimes we're even indifferent to truth. Who cares about the Western concept of truth, we'll be told? What's important is existential relationships. Oh, barf. No wonder my job, you know, in a school of philosophy as a Christian was so hard. When I have people who call themselves Christians endorsing this idea, we believe the absurd because it is absurd. Now, you're probably sitting there, I'm sure you're sitting, I mean, if you're awake, you're sitting there thinking, why would anybody do that? And that's the furthest thing from what you want to do. That seems so suicidal. Well, I'm not going to make it very palatable because I don't think it is palatable, but let me make it a little easier by just telling you this. In one sense of the word religious, that's a very religious thing to do. In one sense. And it's a sense which we see among evangelical Christians, should see among evangelical Christians. And what I mean is, to hold something religiously means that you are committed, that you have faith in it, that you are going to hold on despite the ridicule that comes. Now, the Bible speaks about that. The Bible says the world will call what we believe foolishness. And to be really religious means to hold on to something that appears to be foolish, even though it isn't. Now, in the case that I'm talking about, though, we have people who hold on to things and they say it is foolish. And just because it seems foolish or absurd, they're very religious in holding on to it. If you have had a 19-year-old, let's say you get to college and here's your first roommate, and you find out, come about December, that your roommate is looking forward to Christmas because he or she believes Santa Claus is coming. You'd say, I was 3 or 4. I believe that kind of stuff too. But, I mean, you know better, right? You know it was just your parents doing that, right? I hope I'm not letting anybody down by Sorry if I'm the one to break it to you. No. You talk to your roommate and you say, you know there's no Santa Claus. And your roommate says, all the evidence is against it. I agree. But I'm very devoted to the idea of Santa Claus. Yeah, don't laugh at that. Who was the writer back in the 40s who wrote this famous essay that appears, Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus sort of thing. This idea of there being a Santa Claus has so gripped my heart that I've given my life to Santa Claus. Now, would you say that this person had a lot of religious devotion? Not proper religion. I'm not asking you to endorse it. Yeah, there's a sense in which we call that religious. He holds on to that very religiously, even against the facts. Well, so there are people who think that being religious means believing something that's absurd just because it is absurd. And often we as Christians are put in that category. There are people who think that we elevate the value of our personal faith in direct proportion to the degree that our faith is dubious or blind or mystical. It's thought that believers will degrade the worth of their faith to any extent that their faith accords with good reason. Back in 1895, the insane philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, he was insane, wrote in his book, Antichrist, Attempt at a Critique of Christianity, wrote of his derision toward the attitude that says faith must be brought into line with the facts by saying, this was Nietzsche saying, faith means not wanting to know what is true. Faith means holding to the absurd because it is absurd. But all criticism in this vein flows from a very fundamental mistake about the nature of Christian faith. And one of the best books written in the 20th century, I believe, still, by J. Gresham Machen, entitled What is Faith? Machen, a Presbyterian theologian who fought the battle apologetically with unbelievers and liberals as well as with the world, those who were secular scholars, liberals in the church, unbelievers outside the church. Machen wrote in his book, What is Faith? We believe that Christianity flourishes not in the darkness, but in the light. He said that the Spirit would bring about an awakening in the church, and he said one of the ways in which the Spirit would do that would be through an awakening of the intellect. Machen did not want people to believe in the gospel because it sounded good, even though the scientists and the historians told them it couldn't be true. He fervently resisted what he called the disastrous opposition that has been set up between knowledge and faith. And I quote him, "Faith need not be too humble or too apologetic before the bar of reason. Christian faith is a thoroughly reasonable thing." Are we irrational because we believe the absurd? No. We believe what appears to be absurd to the world, and our job is to show the world that what it believes is in fact the true absurdity. Or to go back to my metaphor, theirs is the plane heading for Boston with no letting off in Chicago. So regardless of what certain misguided spokesmen may say, the Bible itself is not indifferent to logical blunders or factual mistakes. It was just in order to vindicate the truth of his religious claims and conceptions that Moses challenged the magicians of Pharaoh's court. It was just to vindicate the truth of his religious convictions that Elijah competed with and taunted the priest of Baal on Mount Carmel. The Old Testament prophets knew that their words would be demonstrated to be true when their predictions were fulfilled in history for all to see. Notice that when Jesus came into this world, he claimed to be the truth. He saw in his resurrection a mighty sign and wonder that provided evidence for the veracity of his claims and for the apostolic message based upon them. Despite what the Jews and Greeks might think to themselves, wrote Paul, the gospel is in fact the very wisdom of God which destroys the arrogance of worldly philosophy. In 1 Corinthians 1, after Paul had been at the center of Greek philosophy in Athens, he leaves Athens and he writes to Corinth. Very important to see what he says in those first two chapters about the relationship of faith and reason at that point. In 1 Timothy 6, verse 20, Paul spoke of the claims of knowledge falsely so called. You see, Paul was eager to reason with people about Christ. Not because there isn't a place for faith, but because faith is not contrary to reason. In fact, faith, it turns out, is the very foundation for reasoning. Boy, now there's a reversal. Most people think we all have to stand on the platform of reason and then maybe find a place for faith. Paul's attitude was, if you don't have faith, there's no place to reason. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Paul said, bring them on. We're ready for them. Hasn't God made foolish the wisdom of this world? And God has continued to make foolish the wisdom of this world from the first century down to today. And God will continue to do that job of making those who promote reason over against faith look like fools. And he's going to do that job through you. You find that hard to believe. A lot of people looking at you may find that hard to believe. But God's in the business of doing amazing things. And he'll do it with you. know, there was a day when a lot of people would not have bet on David. Here's this little scruffy shepherd kid, too short to be a king, not equipped. All he has is a slingshot going against the world giant. What a great lesson. I hope you haven't consigned that to, you know, the Sunday school past for yourselves. God does great things with weak instruments. And he will continue to make the wisdom of this world crumble before little 19 and 20-year-old college kids who have nothing more but a slingshot and a few well-chosen questions to show that, guess what? The plane of unbelief is still going to Boston. Let's take a break and we'll come back for more. Other concepts of faith that see it as being irrational that you should be aware of and also be able to respond to. We've seen that people think that our faith is contrary to the laws of logic or is contrary to empirical evidence or is actually believing what is absurd just because it's absurd. Faith is sometimes seen as contrary to proof, however, and that's a slightly different concept than what we have up here on the board. The first two notions that we've looked at, violating the laws of logic or being contrary to empirical evidence, is to say that Christian faith is untrue because it's illogical, untrue because it's contrary to the facts. Or in the third case, which is the most violent of all, Christian faith is untrue because it's absurd. And of course, some people think that's wonderful. It should be absurd. But we aren't following that concept of faith. The fourth notion is really in a different category. This is not saying that Christian faith means believing what is untrue. It means believing it contrary to proof. Contrary to proof. People will often protest the presence of any attitude of faith in a person's system of thought or philosophy, maintaining very arrogantly, also naively, to be honest with you, maintaining very arrogantly that they will not believe anything that hasn't first been fully proven to them. They will be led by proof, not by faith. Now, whether somebody's ever put it to you in exactly those words, you know what I'm talking about? I'm led by proof. I'm not like you weak-minded wimps, you Christians, who follow after faith. I need proof. People that say this sort of thing often think that theirs is the spirit of René Descartes. René Descartes. You know good old Descartes? You think about him often? He was a philosopher born in 1596, died in 1650, and is often considered the father of the Enlightenment, certainly the father of any autonomous spirit in philosophy. He was a French scholar, a theoretician, who kicked off the Age of Reason. Descartes was concerned that men should strive to realize and to follow a reliable method for arriving at their beliefs. Descartes wanted a method that would lead to the truth rather than error. He wanted the recipe for sorting out superstition and blindness and misleading notions so that if we followed this recipe, we would finally have nothing left to believe but what is true. And according to Descartes, that method would be the method of doubting everything and criticizing everything you possibly can and accepting nothing to be true which you did not clearly recognize to be true because it survived the method of doubt. If you can doubt it, don't trust it. But if you find something you can't doubt, then that becomes the starting point for knowledge. That probably has occurred to some of you, too. You may not be budding philosophers, but it's occurred to you. If we had a way of getting down to the thing that you can't give up, the thing that's indubitable, then we could build out from that little by little, and then we'd have this secure foundational knowledge we could use for encountering the world. Descartes thought that is the way things should go. He sought to doubt every thought that came into his head. So Descartes would say, am I really eating an apple, or am I only dreaming that I'm eating an apple? I might be dreaming that I'm eating an apple. Have you ever had a dream that was so vivid that when you woke up you were surprised? Because while you were dreaming, you thought it was real. Well, I'll tell you how sophisticated my dreams are. I actually have had dreams where I thought to myself, there's a difference between dreaming and reality. Be careful. All the while dreaming. So Descartes said, am I eating the apple or am I dreaming that I'm eating the apple? Well, I might be dreaming that I'm eating the apple, so I can't make that the foundation of everything that I know. And so he doubted everything until he finally came to what was indubitable. He systematically doubted, and then a door opened to certainty for him, he thought. He thought of something which could not be doubted, and that's his own existence. Isn't that great? And the whole field of philosophy and all the possibilities in this wonderful world in which we live, Descartes found out that the foundation of everything was himself. Now here's a modern man for you. He may have lived in the 1600s, but here's a modern man. You know what's at the center of the universe? Me. Maybe there isn't a God. Maybe there isn't a world out there. Maybe there aren't apples to eat and only dreams to be had, but I know that I exist. You know how he figured that out? He said, because if I'm doubting, then I must at least exist to do the doubting. Right? So maybe I'm doubting, and I'm actually doubting that I'm doubting. Okay, remember eating the apple? He said, I might be dreaming. He said, okay, so maybe I'm dreaming that I'm dreaming. But you see, if I'm dreaming that I'm dreaming or doubting that I'm doubting, it must still be me that's doing the doubting. And so you know what? You can't give up. You can't give up your own existence. From whence we get the English translation, which is misleading. I think, therefore I am. Right? Which leads some teachers to assume that their students don't exist. I think, therefore I am. Technically, dubito ergo sum. I doubt, therefore I must at least exist to do the doubting. Looks pretty good, huh? It's a horrible argument. I had Christian philosophers teach me that that was a good argument. It's not. It's a terrible argument. It's a terrible argument because it begs the question. What did Descartes begin with as his datum? What did he take as his, you know, evidence from which he would draw his conclusion? He took as his datum, I doubt. Now, does anybody see a problem with that little sentence, I doubt, if what you're trying to prove is that you exist? Like maybe he wrote the conclusion right into the premise when he said, I doubt. You say, well, what else could he do? Well, come on, don't be so dull, students. You know English grammar. He didn't have to express it in the first person. He could have said, doubting is occurring. Now, does it follow from the premise, doubting is occurring, that I exist as the doubter? No. Now, you may have a hard time understanding how Descartes could know doubting was occurring if he didn't exist to be the doubter. But the fact is, if he wanted to apply his method stringently, he should not have begged the question. He should have just said, well, I know there's a lot of doubting going on. He shouldn't even said, I know that. He should have said, doubting's going on, from which it does not follow that he exists. So this is not even a terribly good argument. But nevertheless, people today who say they will not follow faith but only proof think they're following Descartes, because Descartes said, doubt everything until you find a firm foundation from which you can then build up the edifice of knowledge. The modern day followers of Descartes who say they'll say they will doubt absolutely everything except nothing without proof are really acting like arrogant fools. Why? Because nobody can doubt everything. That's one of those little nuggets that philosophers sometimes give you. You can go home and think about that for a while. Try to disprove me. I dare you. Nobody can doubt everything. Nobody. If a person truly doubted everything, now, doubting everything means you must doubt your memory of past experiences. So there's no memory you can rely on now. You doubt that. You must doubt your present sensations. And you say, I know I exist. I'm right there. You have to doubt that too. And you have to doubt the connections between your experiences. What do I mean by the connections? Well, I don't want to get technical, but it's the sort of thing you learn when you put your hand on the hot stove and go, ooh, that hurt. And you thought there was a connection between those experiences. You have to doubt the meaning of the words that you use. You have to doubt all the principles by which you reason. And so go ahead, do it. Let's have an experiment right now. Let's see how many of us can doubt everything right now. Everything. Well, of course, if you were to doubt everything, you wouldn't be thinking at all, much less doubting. If you were to doubt everything, there would be no he or she doing the doubting. A fundamental set of beliefs is inescapable for everybody. Everybody has a logically basic set of convictions by which they think and live their lives. That isn't to say everything's at the same level in your thinking. But you see, there are some things which we can kind of doubt, like, I thought I heard a car outside. Man, maybe I was wrong. That's one level. Then there are other things that I might doubt that I understand Heisenberg's indeterminacy principle. But then maybe I do. And then I might doubt that my senses are reliable and so forth. There are different levels, but everybody has some logically basic set of principles and beliefs that they cannot give up. Men only succeed in deluding themselves when they say that they will not accept anything without proof or demonstration. Because, you see, they do not prove their foundational principles in the way they think they do. They do have a place for faith in their outlook, in living their lives. I wonder if you understand why unbelievers don't catch on to this, though. Why do they not realize that they have a foundational faith also? And I'm not talking necessarily about religious matters, although that is included. But they've got a foundational faith about how things are connected in their experience, the meaning of their words, so forth and so on. Why do they not realize that? The answer? They don't realize that because everybody around them is in the same situation. So they think, well, we can take that for granted. It's amazing to me when I debate with unbelievers, both formally and informally, how often that comes up. When you start challenging something they believe, they'll say, well, but everybody knows that's true. Of course, whenever they've done that, I mean, they've just walked right into, you know, my clutches as a philosopher. Everybody knows that? Well, if everybody knows that, then you ought to have a very good reason for it. What is that reason? Well, when so many in the world take for granted we can trust our senses, then unbelievers don't understand it when we come along and say, well, on your worldview, why do you trust your senses? They have a foundational faith, but they think theirs is reasonable. They know that we have a foundational faith, but according to them, ours is unreasonable. And what I want to teach you to do is to turn the tables on them and say, we do have a foundational faith. You're right about that. And our foundational faith makes trusting your senses and the laws of logic and moral absolutes very reasonable. But given your foundational faith, it's not reasonable at all. And so what did I say? The plane's heading for Boston, right? And no one gets to jump out in Chicago. Given your foundational faith, logic is gone, science is gone, history is gone, morality is gone, social harmony is gone, human dignity is gone. What a faith. When people say they will hold to nothing except on the basis of proof or demonstration, they are hypocrites. They cannot live that way. They do not live that way. They don't live by their own standards. And of course, that is one of the highest forms of self-refutation, right? Our refutation. When you show a person that he or she is not abiding by their own declared standards. Well, we need to move on quickly. There's another kind of irrationality that we're sometimes accused of because we hold to the Christian faith. There are people who say, I can't go along with you in terms of Christian faith because in our reasoning, we're not supposed to make any assumptions. No assumptions. And you Christians, you assume all sorts of things. Let me quote a liberal scholar, Charles Gore. He once wrote, "It seems to me that the right course for anyone who cannot accept the mere voice of authority, but feels the imperative obligation to face the arguments and to think freely, is to begin at the beginning and to see how far he can reconstruct his religious beliefs, stage by stage, on a secure foundation, as far as possible without any preliminary assumptions." End of quote. If you're going to be really honest, he says, go back there and reconstruct your religious convictions and don't bring any assumptions in. Stage by stage, step by step, build up what you believe, as it were, from scratch. So what he tells us is you have to look at the religious hypothesis from the beginning without preliminary assumptions, or, now I'm going to introduce another word that you may not be familiar with, without presuppositions. Without anything taken for granted that informs and guides the reasoning process. And as you might know from what I said about the I don't believe anything that's contrary to proof position, you might already realize that what I'm going to say is, well, that's really, literally impossible to think without presuppositions. A complete demonstration of everything that we believe by means of other beliefs. That is, I prove this by appealing to this, and then I prove this by appealing to this, on and on and on. A complete demonstration along the line, proving every belief by independent beliefs cannot be given. It's impossible. For instance, when I prove the truth that ice melts at room temperature, I'm pressing into service certain standards of thinking, certain procedures for demonstration. And so, let's say we have this dispute. I say, ice will melt at room temperature. You say, no, it won't. So I prove that it does. And in so doing, I've rested upon a certain procedure, certain standards, so forth. And then you say, but how do you know you were right about that procedure? How do you know you're right about those standards? How do I know that I've chosen the correct criteria for demonstrating something scientifically? Can I be sure that I have used the standards properly? You say, well, what are you talking about, Dr. Bronson? Well, in this, we have a very simple demonstration. Here's the way I would do it. I would get a glass dish and a chunk of ice, and I would put it in the glass dish, and then I would talk to you for a few minutes at room temperature. And then I would look and say, oh, the ice has melted. You're wrong, I'm right. Ha ha. Great demonstration. Until somebody says, well, how do you know it was room temperature? Now, you didn't even think about that, did you? It's kind of like the magician telling you last night. You don't know what to look for. See, if you want to really be critical, somebody say, well, you'd have to prove it was room temperature in here. Or better yet, how do I know that was a piece of ice? Well, not to be thwarted in my scientific quest, I would then go about proving that it was room temperature and that that was a chunk of ice. But in proving those two things, what would I be relying on? Some other principles and observations, right? And somebody might push even further then. Can I be sure that I've properly used these procedures? Do I know that I have the right procedures to use? Do I have the right beginning conditions or assumptions or non-negotiables in this method? Has my execution of the procedures been faultless? Well, to prove all those things, I'm going to have to use further argumentation, further proof, and on it would go. If there is no assumed starting point for a demonstration, then a demonstration can't get started. Yes, write that one down in your notes. That's one of the good ones. If there is no assumed starting point for a demonstration, then a demonstration can't get started. And, of course, if it can't get started, it can't get finished either. If an unbeliever considers Christianity irrational simply on the basis that it allows for something to be accepted without independent demonstration, then the unbeliever is being unrealistic. And the unbeliever must be pressed to see that he ends up refuting himself, not simply Christianity, in terms of those values and demands. The unbeliever says, you know what's wrong is that you're using presuppositions when you try to defend the faith. Then you must show that the unbeliever is using presuppositions as well. So it comes down to this. If using presuppositions means that you're being irrational, and I've shown that you are using presuppositions, then guess what? You're irrational. And so now you must either accept that we're all in this leaky boat of irrationality or give up your principle that there can be no presuppositions used in an argument. You see, it's the unbeliever's attitude that turns out to be truly irrational because it inconsistently requires something of its opponents which it does not live up to itself. Now, I'm putting this into an intellectual domain. But you know this kind of criticism. You've read about this in the Bible. Paul says this. He says to the Jews, you who criticize others, you who say that God will condemn stealing, do you not rob from temples? Paul says, you don't even live up to your own standards. That's how much of a hypocrite you are. And if you understand that in the moral domain, and I'm sure you do, the people who are going to talk to you this week about socioeconomic sorts of things will be using this over and over again. How people who are liberals in their political principle do not apply to themselves the very principle that they try to use to get rid of Christian or conservative standards. So you know that kind of argument. All I'm saying is that works in the intellectual domain too. If someone says, I'm not going to grant you any presuppositions, you can't try to prove something and you can't have any presuppositions to rest on in trying to prove it, then you just have to turn around and say, okay, well, then you live by that standard. Then you try to prove something, and we won't allow you any presuppositions. And you know what will happen if you do that? I know that your conversation with your roommate will not sound exactly like what I'm talking about. It will not be word for word like this. But it's going to come down to the same issues. And what will happen is your roommate will say, well, my presuppositions are not presuppositions because everybody agrees with me. Mark my words, if you doubt it, you know, you send me $5 when you go off to school and you say, Dr. Bonson, you're right, that's exactly right. Once I show that they've got presuppositions too, then they say, well, yeah, but ours are different because everybody agrees with ours. Yours are the ones that are under question. Well, does that seem just a little bit arbitrary to you? Just a little bit unfair, like we aren't playing on a level field now? It's like your presuppositions can be allowed in without demonstration, but mine can't? Well, guess what? I'll even accept those terms and argue with you. That's okay. I'll give you the higher ground. Your presuppositions, I'm going to allow you to continue reasoning, and I'm going to reason in favor of mine. You say, well, how can you do that, Dr. Monson? You can't prove your presuppositions because they're presuppositions. Well, I'm going to argue for my presuppositions this week by saying, if you don't use my presuppositions, you're going to destroy science and logic and morality and human dignity. And so what you think is the high ground turns out to be the low ground anyway. But you see, I'll argue with one arm behind my back. That's okay. I'll give you the upper hand in this, and you'll still turn out looking like a fool. But not because I'm so smart. It's because you're so stupid. You're uncomfortable with that? If this is just name-calling, you should be. I don't believe in name-calling. And when I've engaged in it, I ask for God's forgiveness. It isn't right. And you don't win any arguments by calling people names. But this may surprise you. The Bible calls unbelievers stupid. The biblical word is fool. And because of the connotations of the word fool in our culture, it's difficult to use that and get people on board. But if you say, you know, that's really stupid, you catch some of the drift, some of the impact of the biblical word fool or foolish. That's really the mark of a fool. You're being really stupid.
What would you make of a person who's on an airplane heading for Boston and they can't get out at Chicago and they don't want to go to Boston? Wouldn't you say that's stupid? I mean, not that they've done this by mistake, like a little old lady might have done in front of me at the airport, but somebody who's on this plane fully committed to the flight of human autonomy. And you say, and it's taking you right into the dumper when it comes to logic. And it's taking you right into the dumper when it comes to science and history and human dignity and moral absolutes. And so they're fully committed to the flight of human autonomy. And then they say, but we don't want to go there. That's stupid. And so I'll argue with one arm tied behind my back, as it were. I'll take on the unbeliever, even on his uneven, unfair terms. Because in the end, when I get done with my argument, he's not going to have any ground to stand on. I'm going to argue that given your worldview, you can't even argue with me. Your principles of argument have been undermined as well as everything else. All right? You're all on the edge of your seat. You want to say, okay, how do I do that? We all want to go for the juggler, don't we? Get them. Well, patient. We'll work it out slowly throughout this week. If an unbeliever considers Christianity irrational because Christians allow something to be accepted without independent demonstration, the unbeliever in question is being unrealistic, I've said. He's being hypocritical, not living up to his own demands. He's the one who's supremely unreasonable. Now, you see, as a Christian, I do not violate the laws of logic. And as a Christian, I don't believe anything contrary to empirical evidence. As a Christian, I do not believe what is absurd because it is absurd. As a Christian, I'm not committed to anything that's contrary to proof. And as a Christian, my convictions are not based on something that has no assumptions. What I'm saying is everyone has assumptions. The problem with us as Christians, if we get down to the bottom of it all, the problem with us as Christians is not that we believe things without evidence. It's that the unbeliever doesn't like the kind of evidence we have. It's another one of those key sentences you want in your notes. The problem is not that we believe things contrary to evidence or without evidence. It's that the unbeliever doesn't like the kind of evidence we have. Many critics, many of your professors, many unbelieving students will finally acknowledge that you as a Christian engage in reasoning. You want to be logical. And you do appeal to evidence in support of your beliefs. Many will admit when you press them that there really isn't anybody to be found, even religious skeptics, who can proceed without any assumptions. There isn't anybody who can prove everything that they believe by independent considerations. And so what they object to finally, as I've told you, is the kind of evidence to which we appeal as Christians. To put it very briefly, what they object to is the idea of believing something on the basis of God's personal authority, rather than on the basis of impersonal and universally accepted norms of observation, logic, and utility. I've got evidence for what I believe. Great evidence, the very Word of God. But they don't want that kind of evidence. See, that's personal. You know what I mean by personal? It's not like just going to a dictionary or to an encyclopedia and looking something up. It's like making a phone call. When people encounter the Word of God, they're encountering not something that you can write down in an encyclopedia and leave it there. They're encountering God Himself. And it makes the unbeliever uncomfortable. And reasonably so. The unbeliever ought to fear God. Because God's very angry with sinners every day. An unbeliever knows that in his or her heart of hearts. The unbeliever doesn't want to have to deal with a personal God. And so when you appeal to the very Word of the living and true Creator of heaven and earth, when you appeal to the Word of the personal God, we want that kind of evidence. When we call for evidence, we want something impersonal, logical, scientific, something that deals with the utility or the usefulness of your beliefs. If you're going to prove Christianity to us, it has to be over here in that kind of arena. We don't want the Word of God to be the evidence that you rested on. Julian Huxley, in his book, Religion Without Revelation, wrote these words, and I quote him, "I believe firmly that the scientific method, although slow and never claiming to lead to complete truth, is the only method which in the long run will give satisfactory foundations for beliefs." And he writes elsewhere, "We quite assuredly at present know nothing beyond this world and natural experience." Well, that's one of those sentences you love to leap on. Listen to this again. "We quite assuredly at present know nothing beyond this world and natural experience." And so, for Huxley, Christian faith shouldn't be grounded in revealed authority. It had to be grounded in the authority of natural science. But now, what does Huxley show us when he says this? He openly displays his own faith commitment with its prejudices against Christianity. Notice he says, on the one hand, that the scientific method cannot give the complete truth. He openly admits the scientific method cannot give the complete truth. And then he turns around and, on the other hand, based on the authority of the scientific method, completely rules out knowing anything beyond the natural world. Now, if you caught that when I was reading it, or if you understand it now, that's a good illustration of how simple apologetics will become. Unbelievers hang themselves. He says, on the one hand, scientific method is slow. We can't know everything. We're working at it. But we can very assuredly tell you there's nothing beyond the natural world. That's kind of like saying, I have no idea what the 1995 Toyota Camry is going to look like, but it won't look like that. Well, if you have no idea what it's going to look like, you can't rule that out. In fact, you can't even tell us what the range of possibilities are. And neither could Huxley. Why does Huxley count out the kind of evidence that is offered by Christians for their faith? Why does he discard revelation as the source of information about God? Because Huxley has a faith commitment, a devotion to natural science. He is committed fully to the natural scientific method, and so he doesn't want any revelation. But does he have a reason for not accepting revelation? Does he have a reason for not having faith in what we have faith in? Yeah, he has a contrary faith. Please catch on to this. The war is not between reason and faith. It's between faith and faith. And I don't mean faith here as just an arbitrary leap, but it's one kind of reasoning process over against another kind of reasoning process, both of which want to use logic, want to use our senses, want to make things work in this world, but one of which admits a word from God and the other doesn't. In his book entitled God and Philosophy, Anthony Flew expresses the unbeliever's criticism of the Christian faith for resting upon authority. This is what he says. An appeal to authority here cannot be allowed to be final and overriding. For what is in question precisely is the status and authority of all religious authorities. It is inherently impossible for either faith or authority to serve as themselves the ultimate credentials of revelation. You need to catch the last part of that. I'll say it again. Flew says, it is inherently impossible for either faith or authority to serve as themselves the ultimate credentials of revelation. What he's saying is that the teaching of Scripture cannot be accepted on the authority of God speaking therein because it is precisely that authority that's under question by the unbeliever. At first, that's got to look reasonable to you. How often have I seen people present that, and at first blush you say, yeah, I mean, you can't appeal to the Bible to prove the Bible. I'll tell you something, think about it. What Flew was saying is that in the end, God's Word cannot be the ultimate authority. I'm stressing the word ultimate here, because all ultimate authorities must authorize themselves. All ultimate authorities must authorize themselves. Yes, if you're nodding off, that's one of the sentences Dr. Bonson wants in your notes. All ultimate authorities must authorize themselves. If somebody says, this is my ultimate authority, then you say, well, how can you prove it? in the verse and says, well, I prove that ultimate authority by appealing to this over here. You go, gotcha. That's not your ultimate authority then, because what you use to prove it is your ultimate authority. When you call something an ultimate authority in the nature of the case, it must prove itself. And so when Anthony Flew says, you can't let the Bible be your ultimate authority, you can't let the Bible prove itself, all he's telling us is, on my philosophical outlook, I'm not going to let the Bible be ultimate. This can only mean that Anthony Flew determined in advance, I stress, in advance, determined that God cannot be the ultimate authority. According to Flew, there must always be something that is independent of God, which is more authoritative than God, and in terms of which the authority of God could be accepted. God's authority cannot be inescapable, and it cannot be self-validating, according to Flew. And I'm going to quote him again. Get this. The philosopher examining a concept is not at that time himself employing that concept, however much he may at other times wish and need to do so. When we're examining a concept, trying to decide whether it's true, he says we can't employ that concept. You can't employ something that you're examining at the same time. That's his rule. And in many, many ways, that's a pretty good rule to follow. But to say that it's a universal rule and applies to everything would make nonsense out of human reasoning. Does Anthony Flew really pretend that as a philosopher, he purely adheres to that general prerequisite? We may not examine something while simultaneously employing it. That is, you can't use the authority of the Bible if what you're examining is the authority of the Bible. Does he use that principle himself? Well, no, he doesn't. And he should know better. He's a good philosopher. He should know better. Those who examine and argue about logic, do you think that they've given up the rules of logic when they argue about logic? Or do they employ the laws of logic while they argue about logic? Well, of course, if they're not using the laws of logic, then they're not arguing at all. They're just being blithering idiots. But they're using the laws of logic while they're arguing about what? The laws of logic. Do you think philosophers argue about the laws of logic? Oh, yeah, they do. And they try to be logical about it. And I applaud them. There's nothing wrong with that. When it comes down to an ultimate standard like that, you've got to use the standard while you're trying to examine the standard. How about those who examine and evaluate the powers and the reliability of the human eyeball? Do you think they say, oh, okay, since we're examining the eyeball, we can't use our eyes? Gee, I can't see anything. I'm not sure what to say now. Of course they don't. They use the eyeball while they examine the powers of the eyeball. And in some cases, they use the eyeball. You do this too, right? Have you ever gone to a mirror and tried to find something in your eye? You're using your eye while you're trying to correct your eye. To wave off and automatically preclude the possibility that Christians could examine and argue about the authority of God's revelation while simultaneously employing the authority of God's revelation is nothing more than arbitrary prejudice on Anthony Flew's part. He allows it when it comes to logic. He allows it when it comes to eyeballs. But he says, no, not with the Bible. It's just I won't even consider that as a possibility. Now, again, I'm not asking Flew or anybody just to accept the Bible willy-nilly. Say, here's the Bible. It claims to be the authority. So now you've got to take it at that. No, I'm saying examine it. Be reasonable. Let's argue about this. But when he says, well, you can't make your ultimate authority the Bible, I'm saying, oh, yes, I can. And I can do it just as much as you can make logic your ultimate authority and still try to be logical. You see, Anthony Flew doesn't want God's word to be self-validating. What is remarkable about his or any other unbeliever's refusal to submit in faith to God's authority on the basis of that authority is that he only discloses that he's committed in advance against the Christian position. In the nature of the case, God's word must be self-validating. What else could validate the word of God except a word from God? But if it takes a word from God to validate the word of God, then you've got the Bible validating itself when all is said and done. Now, that's the internal logic of the position. Now imagine somebody says, oh, I see. If there is a God and if he reveals himself, it would be his word that tells us what his revelation is. And so that means his word must validate his word. I got that, but I'm not going to allow that as a possibility. I rule that out in advance. There cannot be a God that speaks with such authority. Does that sound like a faith commitment to you? I will not allow the possibility that there is such a God. The funny thing is, without showing it openly, although sometimes they do, but usually not showing it openly, unbelievers have this wild, arbitrary, volitional commitment that is not thought out so badly, and yet that's the very thing they accuse Christians of doing. They're the ones who say, no, I won't even consider the possibility of that. Who has faith? I know you're kind of confused now, don't you? Who really has the faith position? When I debated an atheist at the University of California, Irvine, a number of years ago, one of the things I said to him at one point is, you know, that's the problem with the atheist position. It takes so much faith to believe it. He didn't like that. But that's the point I'm trying to make to you. When you go off to college, or if you're in college now, you represent faith. But many people don't understand what that means. Many people will accuse you of being irrational. It's important that you know what faith really is and how it is to be defended. And especially important that you know that you're not dealing from a position of faith with people who stand on the position of reason. But rather, you hold to a faith that will save reason and will make it reasonable to use reason, whereas the unbeliever does not. This is what we're going to play out for the rest of the week as we continue to watch the airplane of unbelief and autonomy head for Boston.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.